X-Rail Eugene Nichols versus John Litcher. And we will hear first from Mr. LaFave representing Eugene Nichols. Mr. LaFave, you're representing pro bono basis, are you? Well, what that means is that Mr. LaFave has volunteered. Are you doing it through the State Bar Appellate Program? Counsel?
That's right, you are.
On behalf of the State Bar, has an appellate section, appellate law section, and lawyers have volunteered to take cases of people who cannot afford counsel and do this task without a charge. And we want to thank you. You might get our thanks whether you win or not is not yet determined. This case, before you begin, in the interest of time, although there's enough in the hour, presents a simple fact situation, simply stated issue, hard to decide. So we'll proceed recognizing that in our time limitations. Mr. LaFave.
Good morning. Pro bono legal, for the public good, is why I am here today before you, representing Mr. Nichols, asking you to reinstate his tardy petition. Noted civil rights advocate Martin Luther King Jr. once wrote, "An injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere." The sentiments he expressed when he wrote those words, penned almost 40 years ago while he was being detained in an Alabama prison, hold true today. Indeed, their truth is being manifested in a profound way this week as countries throughout the world join us in our outrage over the terrorist attacks that have rocked our nation. An injustice which other countries rightfully fear may spread to their shores. While of a different magnitude, there is an injustice in this individual case, one that should concern each one of us here today. And that injustice arises because this court rejected Mr. Nichols' petition, not because his arguments lacked substantive merit, but because his petition arrived in the clerk's office one business day late due to mailing impediments that he was entirely powerless to correct. These mailing impediments stem from the state's unilateral decision to ship Mr. Nichols against his will to a far removed prison that had erratic mail service and institutional rules that frustrated his ability to get his petition here on time, even though he had completed it 10 days before it was due. It is the impact of the state's seemingly unfettered power to ship Mr. Nichols to a distant prison against his will that is particularly troubling here. The state concedes that Mr. Nichols had as much as 12 fewer days within which to prepare his petition for review as a result of his imprisonment in Oklahoma. Yet the state provides no legal authority to justify indiscriminately shortening a prisoner's allotted 30-day period of time to prepare his or her petition for review under such circumstances.
Mr. LaFave, doesn't the state agree with you as to the remedy that you're requesting in this case?
I don't think so, Your Honor.
Where are you different? Where's the argument?
We differ in the preferred method of executing the proper relief in this case. It is not by accident that we advanced habeas corpus relief as the preferred method of adjudicating this particular injustice. And that is because it provides this court with the narrowest grounds upon which to correct the injustice by reinstating his petition. Through habeas corpus, this court is not required to make a finding that Section 808.10 is unconstitutional. This court is not required to go beyond the unique and very unfortunate circumstances of this case to implement a rule that perhaps some may view to be beyond the court's ability in keeping with a principled statutory analysis of the underlying rules.
Don't you want us to find, basically, that when a prisoner such as your client has turned over the documents, the petition for review, to prison authorities, that is filing under the statute?
Your Honor, that is a grounds that we've advanced, a secondary grounds, and indeed we feel that there is a good faith basis in the law, and indeed a rich tradition that is growing day by day, as we've illustrated by the case that we provided the court just earlier this week. Yet another jurisdiction that has found that if, and I think that's the stumbling block for the minority jurisdictions, if the court can find sufficient ambiguity in the term filing, then certainly justice and public policy considerations militate strongly in favor of implementing a prison mailbox rule. No question.
Counsel, as Justice Brooks stated, the rule you want, when a prisoner such as your client has turned over documents to prison authorities, that constitutes filing. Your client is in an out-of-state prison. Would the same rule apply to somebody in Wisconsin? Because errors can be made, the prison may have perfectly good rules, but it gets mislaid, lost, ultimately found, etc.
Unquestionably, it would apply to a prisoner in Wisconsin. There is a ready example that has recently been adjudicated, the Shimkus decision, which is a perfect illustration of how the system, even in our state, can break down and deny an individual prisoner his or her day in court due entirely to circumstances beyond their control. There is no question that it is the inability of the individual prisoner to control either the means of getting the documents to the courthouse and actually having to rely on those who he or she might argue is antagonistic to the exercise of that right, that really make even those like Justice Scalia who have written and voiced concern about how to implement it, they make people like Justice Scalia say, this is a good rule. You don't see even the minority decision saying, this is a bad rule, it's an unjust rule, it's a fair rule.
Is the rule applicable also then to people who are involuntarily committed? The same rationale should apply to people who are involuntarily committed in mental institutions and mental health care institutions.
I think that logically you would need to extend it to that area too, although what we have seen, again, in keeping with the judicial philosophy of let's decide each case on its individual grounds, that you see these other decisions expanding to different settings, the prison mailbox rule from Houston.
Is there a principal distinction between that and someone who is in a psych ward in a hospital? In other words, if your premise is that the individual has no control over their environment and no ability to get to courthouse steps, is there a principal distinction between what you're advancing in that circumstance?
I really don't think so. And in fact, in considering this case, I have found analogies to the concepts that we employ for using or analyzing potential disabilities or impairments for people who may be subject to statutes of limitation. It is the inability of the individual to control or operating under an impairment like that that really prevents them from acting in a conscientious, assertive way to exercise their rights. And we have in numerous settings not made accommodations for those disabilities or impairments.
Well, what about someone who's physically ill? The hospital gives the letter to the hospital authorities, nurse on duty, with instructions to get this mailed.
It would depend, I would think, I would want more facts, among other things, that individual, are they representing themselves pro se?
Yes.
Are they truly unable to afford representation?
Indigent.
Under that type of a circumstance, one could make, a principled argument that just as in the setting of Fallon versus the United States, which had some factual similarities. The individual was a quadriplegic or paraplegic in the hospital because of flu. The fact that he was a prisoner in that case really wasn't what I think was fundamentally the reason why he could not get his paper in on time. And I think the court recognized that.
Also, as a practical matter, as Justice Crooks asked and you explained, I see that even though you were trying to show the difference that the state's position and yours are basically the same, but as a practical matter, I'm just envisioning this mailbox rule could have some concerns only because when you give when you drop something in a mailbox, it's in the mailbox, when you give something to someone in hand, and we're dealing with hundreds of these, there could be some difficulties. What is your opinion, or how do you practically, and you discussed the person in the hospital, the person involuntarily committed, I'm just envisioning, well, yes, you hand this to some nurse who's on call, and you say, here's my petition. I can envision some possible difficulties as to what I gave you when. How is that to be realistically effectuated so that it's fair to both sides?
The means by which the court would police this,
yes,
is indeed a troubling and momentous issue. We've considered that at some length. I am troubled by the hypothetical that the Chief Justice threw out because it almost suggests that the individual may not have the mental capacity, wherewithal, to do something as simple as writing out a certificate of service, which, if the rule were announced publicly, the healthcare provider could view, and if it was grossly out of whack, provide either input to the court that this is not truly the date, this is the date we provided it. But
well, that's my question for not only that, but in these others where you have could have this potential debate many times, particularly if it was not looked upon favorably here by this court as to when it really got there or what actually happened.
There are a couple of scenarios that we've seen play out in these cases, and also some that I think that this court and others have anticipated in some of the rules that were proposed and that were kind of shelved earlier this year.
Held for this case.
Exactly. I think that there are strong arguments to be made for a simple certificate of service or affidavit of mailing that would be provided by the litigant, which would create, as Florida has recognized, a presumption, a rebuttable presumption, that, for example, in the context of a prison or a correctional facility, the state could provide means, whether it's through outgoing mail logs, or otherwise to challenge. But that would give a written black and white date that at least stands in the first instance as the benchmark. It's not subject to a swearing contest one way or the other. It's there. It can be disputed. It can be challenged and rebutted. But it at least operates as a firm benchmark. I'm troubled by when some of the courts use the postmark, they look at the envelope. What happens if that gets defaced? What happens if someone throws it out not realizing that this is a pro se litigant? Whoops, can't say when they filed it. Those are very, I think, problematic ways of going about doing things.
Some, not only cross-check, but you wouldn't want to have, in fact, I think that has the potential for disagreement on both sides. Perhaps it would have to be where there's not only a certificate of service, but some book kept that was signed by that person that it placed.
We suggested in our papers the opportunity, actually almost providing an individual log, you could analogize it to a certificate of service, that the prison official would sign off at the same time that the prisoner mails it out. That's the kind of record that we have here. But that really came as a result of Gene Nichols having to have money drawn from his account to pay for the postage. So you could certainly accomplish that here. One of the concerns that we had, again, in considering these options, is what if you're in the situation of a prisoner that is truly antagonistic to the people who are the correctional officers, and they refuse to sign off on it? They just simply will not take it. They put him or her in isolation. That's why it would seem to cure the concerns and address the inequities of the situation, you would want to put, as a first instance, the ability, the control, in the individual litigant's hands to decide, okay, this is the date that I'm writing down, that I'm turning these over. Now, if the state wants to rebut that, it has the means, it has the resources by which to either set up logs or to examine those certificates as they go out and to police it.
Wasn't this a discussion about logistics? Seem to indicate that the adoption of this sort of a prison mailbox rule would be better accomplished by legislation or amendment of the rule by the court rather than in a creative interpretation of statutes and the decision of this court.
As an officer of this court, I agree. As Mr. Nichols' advocate, I believe it provides a defensible, good faith basis by which to afford him relief. That's why we advanced it as a secondary basis, but one that I think does have strong support throughout the country.
I mean, you don't disagree that it takes a very creative interpretation of these rules to essentially read in a prison mailbox rule.
The state was perceptive in pointing out that there was not an extended exegesis statutory construction in our brief, and that is the reason for it. I think it does take creativity. It is kind of an exercise in creating legal fiction. Legal fictions have a great place in our judiciary and our legal heritage. Legal fictions, we talk about, for example, in this case, legislative intent. I think Mr. Nichols was dead on when he said in his original petition for habeas corpus relief that the legislature in our state did not contemplate subjecting a prisoner that had been shipped 1,000 miles away from Madison trying to get his petition in on time through the mails. I just don't think they contemplated that. So to try to go out and divine legislative intent, I think you're looking at an empty set. In this circumstance, that is why we believe you can operate using basic constitutional principles to correct this injustice and perhaps leave for another day or through other means the implementation of a prison mailbox rule, which we passionately believe is the most just and proper rule to apply for these kinds, for these the reasons we set forth.
The constitutional resolution of this case would seem to me to be to raise much broader issues than what you characterize as a creative approach to statutory interpretation. But once you start, explain what you think the constitutional doctrine is, and then think about, as you do that, how it applies to involuntarily institutionalized people, voluntary institutionalized people, people in voluntary in a treatment center, people in a hospital. If there's a constitutional right, we're off and running.
I think that the constitutional issue, what I tried to suggest in my opening comments, you do not have to find that this statute is constitutionally infirm for it to go. Rather, what you have to conclude is that under the unique circumstances of this case, Mr. Nichols was discriminated against in terms of his constitutional right, which is unquestioned, to have meaningful, equal access to this courtroom. Both Dowd and Cochran make it crystal clear. If you discriminate as a state against an individual appellant, that is a 14th Amendment due process violation. That doesn't mean the rules you have in effect are constitutionally violative. It means that there has been a constitutional violation. A hypothetical that we consider, for example, would be, to use your example of someone who might be infirm, if an individual locked up a party in a room and held them hostage for 30 days at gunpoint, while their period under 808.10 ran, let them out the last day, the day after it had run, and they filed their petition for review late, I would passionately argue that there has been a deprivation of a constitutional right there, whether it's a state actor or otherwise. That person has been deprived of a right for meaningful access to this courtroom. And it's interesting because a number of people have alluded to the portraits in this hall. I couldn't help but looking at the one that is to the court's right of the signing of the Magna Carta. And I was reminded of our discussion, and we referred to the right for the remedy for wrongs provision in the Wisconsin Constitution, which has its antecedents in paragraph 40 of the Magna Carta, which states, "To none will we sell, to none will we deny or delay right or justice." I think
you rely on Article 1, Section 9 of the Wisconsin Constitution.
That is right, Your Honor. That is, this court in Acre said that Article 1, Section 9 grows out of that particular provision in the Magna Carta. I believe that to drain that constitutional provision of any substantive right under circumstances such as this would be an injustice. And indeed, the Oklahoma Supreme Court construed the almost identical constitutional remedy for wrongs provision and concluded that that clear language requires that the courts must be open on the same terms without prejudice to all.
Well, counsel, I don't know, but I would bet that mail has been seriously disrupted in downtown. Mail has been seriously disrupted in downtown New York City and close to the state and federal courthouses that are there. And the documents that, according to New York law, had to be filed with the court on a particular date are not going to be filed because the people that went through the mail will be late. And I would bet that the courier services are not going to make it through the rubble. You think that's a constitutional deprivation of of their rights, or you think that if, assuming that had been in Madison or in Wisconsin, a deprivation of rights, you think it's a way of the court saying that, sure, that's the rule, but there are always exceptions that that can be read in?
We thought about that very scenario yesterday. Mr. Davis and I, as we were preparing for oral arguments, I believe that there are principled pressure release valves in the system by which this and other courts can address those sorts of extraordinary circumstances. The one that quickly comes to mind for me is this court's power under Article 7 to issue all writs necessary in aid of its jurisdiction, one that has a statutory basis in 751.07 that somewhat expands on that and says this court has the authority to issue all writs in the administration of justice. So I believe that there are built-in safeties that can address those kinds of extraordinary circumstances.
Without going to due process. I'd like to talk to you for a moment about the floodgates rule. I had in my file about 30 seconds ago and now I've lost it. There's at least one other case pending before this court that raises very similar issues. The one that I'm referring to is the one that where the there was a delivery to the prison officials on day one with notice to the officials that it had to be mailed by day three. And it was not so mailed, and then the result was it was late. I mean, that has not been a decided case. It's pending decisions here. So my question to you, you heard the prior argument talking about how many cases we're talking about. We get 1,000, roughly, petitions a year, a little less than that, 900. This is going to increase it.
My red light is on, Your Honor. May I answer?
Yes, you may, sir.
Whether it increases it substantially or not, I think I would take the default of the two advocates who preceded me here this morning. I don't know that I could quantify that. I really don't. I think it would be gross speculation on my part. I think it gets back to the old cliche, the devil is in the details. And as Justice Wilcox has commented, I think those get to the nuts and bolts of how you would implement such a rule, and there can be some real sticky issues.
Thank you, Mr. Lefebvre, for your argument, and thank you for agreeing to take this case. And you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Assistant Attorney General James M. Freemuth. So tell us what exactly is the position of the state.
May it please the court, I'm Assistant Attorney General James Freimuth, representing the state officer in this original habeas action. The narrow issue is whether this court should entertain Mr. Nichols' petition for review after the 30-day, having been received in the clerk's office after the 30-day deadline of the statute passed. The broader issues are, could and should this court read a prison mailbox rule into the statute, and must it do so? And then a related concern extending beyond this case is whether if a mailbox rule is read into the statute, it should apply retroactively or, as the state has argued, prospectively only. In 4 points, I'd like to outline the state's position, especially since it has evolved since our original habeas response to the briefing in this case. First, a prison mailbox rule need not be read into the statute to render it constitutional on its face or as applied to Mr. Nichols. Second, however, in light of Houston versus Lack, which is the U.S. Supreme Court prison mailbox case, and our recent Court of Appeals decision in Shimkus versus Sandel, this court could reasonably construe the statute as encompassing a prison mailbox rule. It could just as reasonably, however, defer the subject to formal rulemaking. If it did that, then the state's position would be that Mr. Nichols should not be given habeas relief. Third, if a mailbox rule is read into the statute, it should apply prospectively only, but in fairness include Mr. Nichols. Finally, in the alternative, if this court were to conclude that a mailbox rule cannot or need not be read into the statute, but that Mr. Nichols should be given some form of relief, whether on constitutional grounds, as was pointed out in the previous argument, as a matter of exercising writs from the court in the exercise of its jurisdiction, the state believes the most suitable basis would be a due process, case-by-case, meaningful access to the court's basis. And I would reiterate, however, that the state does not believe a due process violation has occurred in Mr. Nichols' case. Finally, something that just occurred to me last night and again this morning as I was sitting here, and it stems in part from experience that in many pro se instances, the petitioner and the pro se prisoner will file something called a motion to extend time. And this court, I think, invariably has construed that as a timely filing of the petition.
Right. And advises them to file their papers.
Right. In effect, in a practical sense, it's reading the so-called jurisdictional statute as non-jurisdictional. It's giving the prisoner an opportunity to provide rules later on, or provide reasons later on. And so I'm suggesting
that's only if that piece of paper comes in timely. There was no piece of paper here coming in timely.
That's correct. Where I'm going with this is it occurs to me that perhaps this statute was created when the Court of Appeals was created in 1979.
That was a legislative enactment, right?
And the first case, as I understand it, to interpret it was the Nicolau case, in which the court effectively concluded that it was a jurisdictional statute. I suppose this court could, in light of the development or light of passage of time, overrule Nicolau and read the statute as non-jurisdictional. In that case, it would be motions for good cause to extend it. Again, they'd have to be filed in advance. Now, this is just something that occurred to me overnight, so I have no further argument on it except that...
Stifle your thoughts.
Sorry?
I'm teasing you. I'm saying stifle your thoughts. That said the gist.
What year is the Nicolau case?
Nicolau, 1979,
I believe. We've since then said that that statute is jurisdictional, too, though.
There have been some cases, but I don't think anything real recently...
Dismissed a lot of petitions that weren't timely. They are dismissed automatically.
Nicolau is always cited, it seems to me, as the basis for that.
Right.
That's the 89 case, St. John's Home of Milwaukee.
Right, that's the follow-up case on it, too, right.
Counsel, I asked the opposing counsel the same question as far as the workings of the mailbox rule. Now, obviously, both sides have cited cases. Other states have the mailbox rule. The federal court has the mailbox rule. So when you suggest holding off, setting this up for rulemaking, are you indicating that if we were to accept that this is a subject that you're concerned about how this would be operated in the state of Wisconsin and in our other prison systems outside the state?
Right. I'm uncomfortable, I guess, with the scope of how this would apply, not only to pro se prisoners, but to people in comparable situations. Involuntary civil commitments was brought up. I'm also not comfortable. And in Houston, in the federal system, they made the point in the Houston case that there was an established login system, and it didn't appear to be much of an effort to have to worry about logging in. On the other hand, I tend to agree with Mr. Lefebvre that I think an answer around that might be just an affidavit of service filed with the petition itself. If a pro se prisoner is concerned that maybe the timing is going to be late, get an affidavit from a proper prison official, attach it to the petition, and that would at least be prima facie proof or presumptive proof of filing.
Well, it would seem to me that looking at these other cases, that there obviously are workable systems out there. So I that's why I asked that. You're saying that you don't disagree with that.
That's correct. Yeah, there is. As far as I understand it, there's no login system right now in place. In other words, they don't. When an inmate gives a parcel to be mailed, there's nobody there logging it in. This is the date, and so forth. There also are some delays that are inherent in the system, depending upon individual cases as far as whether there are funds available, for example, for photocopying, for postage. My general impression, and this is not in the record, this is from the email that I got, response that I got from the prisons, but I'll offer it for what it's worth. Photocopying can take a day or two, generally max, in state prisons, and checking on a legal loan for postage, for example, I think can run maybe up to a week. So I think in-state prisons, usually within a 5 to 7 day period. Now, out-of-state, the additional, I think in this case, there were 6 days that were attributable just to the mail being delivered. So I think the out-of-state prison situation, something that probably wasn't considered when the statute was enacted, has exacerbated that and has cut into the time that those inmates obviously have to prepare and send out a petition for review.
Counsel, the Houston court adopted a post office rule that said that giving it to the prison authorities constitutes filing. In Shimkus, Judge Ike specifically put it on a different basis. He says that it constitutes the tolling of the statute. Which rule would you advocate and why? What's the different, what are the necessary implications of each of those findings?
Well, I'm not sure I fully understand where the tolling concept came from. I guess it's a way of, a different way of complying with the notion that the statute is being complied with, and yet they're not construing filed any differently than existing precedent. You know, it is a stretch to construe filed to mean delivered to the proper prison official in case of pro se prisoners, but there is precedent in our law for interpreting a statute differently depending on the particular circumstances that are presented. That's where the state has had problems with this, and not that it's not a good idea, but how do you get there?
Well, should we say that this constitutes filing, or should we say it tolls the statute? What do you recommend?
I can't say that I've thought about which is a preferable. I haven't thought about the tolling to any great extent.
Are there times when we prefer to say that it's tolling the statute? For instance, if there's filing fees involved or anything of that sort? In other words, what's the better approach?
I'm not sure. I guess I don't know. Because I haven't thought about the tolling aspect fully enough, I guess, to you know, how far down the road. My focus has been on the filing, I guess, so I guess I'd hesitate. I'd be speculating on which would be the best.
There may be a difference in terms of how much damage we do to our existing precedent, how we define filing. Am I wrong? I'm just...
I think when you start talking about statutory interpretation and filed meaning received by the clerk of court or received by the record custodian, there is some concern there that, you know, are we overruling that principle? But I think, as I said, I think depending on the circumstances, filed could have different meanings, and one of which, without going too far in interpreting filed too far afield, is to say that if it's given to the proper official to be kept on file, that in this case a prison official, that officer would be acting in the stead of the clerk of court, and it wouldn't be doing harm to the precedent on the meaning of file. It's being given to the proper record custodian for kept on file.
I looked up 801.16, which deals with commencement of actions. This is trial court. And it says, the filing of pleadings and other papers with the record as required by these statutes shall be made by filing them with the clerk of circuit court. Sort of a funny expression because you define filing by the word filing. So as I read it, it means filing means delivery to the clerk of circuit court. So it's specifically defined there. So the question is, as you stated, do you have different people for purposes of filing depending on where the filer is sitting, like in a prison?
I think that's conceivable. In Houston versus Lack, for example, one of the appellate rules that was being interpreted said it had to be filed with the district court. And the Supreme Court said, you know, that's not relevant to the meaning of filed, that's just location. That doesn't necessarily inform, you know, what filed means. So I think the same thing here could be construed. Again, I'm, you know, it's a stretch, and that's, like I say, where we had problems with trying to read that in there.
Now, you know, it might have been better for a rule, but there is a rule pending awaiting now, or a decision. Regardless of our decision, there might be a rule relating to receipt. So of these, and this is the same kind of question that Justice Babish asked, you gave us six alternatives. What is the Department of Justice's position as to the best alternative for the proper administration of justice in this state? And one of your alternatives is just say no, right?
You could just say no, right? If you decide that there's no prison mailbox rule, then I think you have to consider whether there are extraordinary circumstances in this case for either a due process, case-by-case analysis, or
right.
You know, exercising the writ.
Okay, what are you going to take? And one of these, if you didn't do it, is you just say no, you hold to a flat-out day rule, regardless of where the person is, conscious or unconscious, you just go straight forward.
And then you'd look at each individual case on the circumstances, right?
No.
Is that what
you're... No, why should you? The rule's a rule. Just do it.
That would not be our position, I guess. I mean, our position is that the best option is the prison mailbox rule. If the court, like we, have problems with how do you get there and formal rulemaking is the better avenue, and yet it still feels that in this particular case Mr. Nichols is entitled to relief, then our suggestion would be do it not on equal protection, not on finding the statute unconstitutional, but finding that either there are extraordinary circumstances here to use the court's writ power, or to find a due process violation and go that route.
But you didn't want us to use the constitutional power.
No, that's the alternative if you don't read it into the statute, if you don't read the rule.
So is your best shot read it into the statute? Is that it?
I think so, right.
Reading into the statute, or tolling, as Justice Babbage raised. When I look at the St. John's Home of Milwaukee, whatever method of delivery is used, a petition for review must be physically received in the clerk's office within 30 days of filing. Now, 30 days to be delivered to the clerk's office within 30 days of filing is jurisdiction. Now, if the clerk of this court does not receive the petition for review for filing within 30 days, the court is deprived of subject matter jurisdiction to review that decision.
Now, that's pretty strong language on jurisdiction. I guess I would say that the circumstances in that case was not dealing with the circumstances in this case.
No, but that language is just pretty bold.
Sure. But the meaning of filed, I think, could be read differently in this particular circumstance. That ambiguity can exist depending in the meaning of a word or phrase in a statute, depending on the particular circumstances under which or that are facing the court in construing the statute.
Or we may have to soften that language, huh?
I'm sorry.
We may have to soften that language.
That's correct. I think so.
As I recall, in that case, a law clerk was here after hours, and someone gave to the law clerk as they were leaving this late petition for review, and so the clerk's office was closed, but the law clerk put it on the desk, and ergo this language. Is that your understanding? Recollection of the St. Joseph's case?
Oh, no, I'm sorry. No, I did not recall the facts of the case. I'm sorry. I guess I just touch a little bit on the constitutional concerns. With respect to the challenge to the statutes on its face, the 30-day period clearly applies across the board on its face, so I don't think you could reasonably argue that the statute is unconstitutional on its face. With respect to the as-applied argument, at least with the equal protection, I would argue that Mr. Nichols really has put himself in that category. This is a direct appeal. He had the right to counsel on direct appeal, including petitioning for review in this court, and he chose not to have counsel. So for him now to argue that it's unfair compared to prisoners with counsel is really disingenuous. We called it judicial estoppel. Maybe waiver is a better argument, that he chose his position and he should now be heard to complain that he's being treated unequally.
Counsel. Yeah.
Go ahead.
I revert back to a question that bothers me, and it's the slippery slope question that we started engaging in. Can you think of any principled distinction? If your elements that you most are concerned with is that the individual is number one, pro se, and number two, these aren't the exact words, but in essence, not in control of his or her environment.
Right.
Euphemistically. Can you think of any principled distinction if we would enact a mailbox rule for pro se out of state prisoners, as opposed to pro se in-state prisoners, pro se in-state mental institution, pro se in-state psych ward, pro se in-state quadriplegic? Any principled distinction?
That would justify the distinction? I don't think so. I think in practice the situation of the civil commitments, I'm not experienced in that area, but my guess would be that most of the time they're going to be represented. Or, I mean, if they're really, truly incompetent, for example, that that situation isn't going to arise without an attorney present. I haven't thought about if you make this an out-of-state prison mailbox rule versus an in-state prison, whether you've now created problems on equal protection grounds or some other grounds for in-state. But I guess I would hesitate going there. I would make it across the board. If there are no further questions, I will proceed this along and thank the court.
Could the turning over of the petition to prison authorities be construed as a request for an extension? Timely.
Could it be construed as an extension in the sense of asking the court for more time? I hadn't thought about it. I suppose that's another characterization that could be given, although the court hasn't seen anything at that point. I suppose that's a character. It would be like the tolling characterization, a little different way of saying that we're not construing filing differently, but we're going to say that giving it to the prison mailbox rule is like the pro se inmate who does make an extension motion to the court directly, and say that in that instance that would be sufficient at least to preserve the jurisdiction for the petition when it's ultimately filed. I just haven't thought about those different characterizations and what that might mean. If there are no further questions, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Freiman.
respond to two questions, one by, I think, Justice Babbage and one by the Chief Justice, but before I do that, I want to address the notion that this is not a discriminatory denial of constitutional rights. The state has conceded at least 9 days, as much as 12 days, were lost out of 30 to file Mr. Nichols' petition for review. If this is not checked, what is to prevent the state from moving prisoners further away from Madison, in more remote facilities, exposing them to even further impediments to exercising their right to access to this and other Wisconsin courts? I see none. Justice Babbage, as to which would be more preferable, one could make, I think, a strong argument that tolling might be more preferable. There is a developed body of law. I analogize to statutes of limitations and people operating under disabilities, which could be extended to people who are committed against their will. Certainly other states, in context somewhat similar, factually similar to this one, that is, prisoners who have been institutionalized in facilities out of state, have adopted equitable tolling rules. Not mentioned in our briefs because it's something I recently came across, it's the case of Martinez versus State, 944 P. 2nd, 127. It's Idaho Court of Appeals decision from 1997. As to whether there is a problem in determining whether filing for one circumstance in the circuit court, as the Chief Justice mentioned, and maybe a different rule for the Supreme Court or the appellate courts, one of the things that came to us as we reviewed this, and again, it certainly seems susceptible to a rule by this court, and that is filing can be considered to be done when a brief is put in the mail with the certificate of service and it is clearly marked, file marked, on a date with a mail stamp. The Supreme Court, the Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure for the United States Circuit Courts of Appeal, all have a mailbox type rule. It seems that that is something that would be workable for this court as well.
Isn't there a distinction to be made that filing of a brief isn't jurisdictional and the filing of a petition for review we have on several occasions said is jurisdictional?
There is certainly a distinction, but one does not, I think, frustrate the purpose of a jurisdictional order by acknowledging that one can trigger or secure this court's jurisdiction on a given date certain. But there is clearly a difference, a conceptual difference, between getting your brief in on time, which is, if someone missed the date, it's not jurisdictional, that's right.
Note that 808.10, which is the statute, says file this petition for review in the Supreme Court. 809.62, which is our rule on this, says file with the Supreme Court. Our cases say file with the Supreme Court under 809.62 means get it into however you want. You get it into the clerk of Supreme Court before the close of business hours at 5 p.m. on an open day. I don't know whether the clerk's office is going to be open this afternoon, but we've had cases where the clerk's office is closed, and it may not be a regular holiday, but something special happened. And what our rules are, I don't know. But do you find any guidance or help in file in, file with, and then special, interpretation of our own rule to say that means the clerk of the Supreme Court from 7:45 to 5 p.m.
I find no help in the distinction in the language. I believe, as I've expressed earlier today, one must engage in a level of creative statutory construction or a legal fiction.
Haven't we already done that by saying file with the Supreme Court does not mean leave it with the seven justices, but leave it in a clerk's office that is in a separate building now than the Supreme Court sits?
That is why I mentioned just a moment ago, Chief Justice, that I think that the court could establish a rule, whether it's in a case or through the rulemaking procedures, which defines file. That's nowhere set forth for this court in the statutory enactment that we have. It has been subject to judicial construction in the Nicolau and other cases. There's nothing that would prevent this court from saying filing with, meaning filed or filed with the court means X, Y, and Z. And a deputized agent of the court in this circumstance could be a prison official. If I could have the court's indulgence of 1 minute and to close. I have a red light.
I know you do, but counsel, make it a minute.
In my concluding remarks, I would like to highlight a passage from Mr. Nichols' petition for writ of habeas corpus, which I believe speaks volumes. Quote, Nichols is not supernatural and is severely hampered by the North Fork copy system, as well as by its delayed mailing apparatus. Close quote. In filing this petition, Mr. Nichols has appealed to this court's sense of justice and fairness as an equitable tribunal. On behalf of Mr. Nichols, I urge the court to correct the individual injustice by reinstating and considering his petition on the merits. By correcting the injustice in this individual case, Wisconsin citizens will be made more confident that their fundamental rights and freedoms will not be threatened elsewhere. It is truly for the public good. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Lefebvre. Thank you, Mr. Frymuth. The hearing is closed.